This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
The first message we've got this month is from Ron Davison, who first of all says thanks for always putting on a great podcast, so thanks for that, Ron. But secondly, he wanted to send us some information that might be useful to the gentleman who inquired about astronomy for the blind in the last Ask an Astronomer I did. He says, if you listen to the March 6th podcast of 365 Days of Astronomy, which is on 365daysofastronomy.org, the presenter discusses how to watch a solar eclipse if it's overcast, but in other words cloudy, by using a chart recorder and a simple antenna and amplifier to monitor the radio emissions from the sun. And if you were to use an audio amplifier in addition to that system, then a blind person will be able to actually experience the eclipse hourly by listening basically to the radio signal coming from the sun that passes through the clouds. And he thinks that would be a unique way to experience an eclipse. So thanks for that, Ron. That's certainly worth a try if you've got the equipment, and perhaps we'll return to that in future, since we've also done that ourselves actually at Jodrell Bank with a partial solar eclipse that happened in 2008. So we might put some information up about that and return to it in a future episode. Second question we've had sent in from Mark Jones in San Antonio in Texas, and he says, when viewing an image of a galaxy as seen at an angle, such as the Andromeda Galaxy, to what extent is the image distorted by the fact that the galaxy is rotating and the light from the far side of the galaxy has travelled many thousands of light years further than the light from the near side? In essence, we should be seeing a lag in the rotation of the far side of the galaxy as compared to the near side. Is this correct? Is this lag long enough to cause a significant distortion in the image? Okay, an interesting question. Of course, the point here is that light travels at a finite speed, about 300,000 kilometres every second, which is pretty damn quick. But on the scale of a galaxy, it still takes that light, for example, in the Milky Way, it takes that light 100,000 years to cross the galaxy. And therefore, it's true to say that when you look at one of these distant galaxies, let's say the Andromeda Galaxy, which is the nearest large spiral galaxy to our own, then the light from the far side of the galaxy is taking several tens of thousands, maybe 100,000 years longer to reach us than the light from the near side. It depends on what angle the galaxy is tipped at relative to us. But it's certainly true that we're seeing the stars on the far side of a galaxy at an earlier point in time, effectively, than the stars on the near side. Now, typically, 100,000 years for the light travel time across a galaxy sounds like a long time. But of course, in general, many timescales in astronomy are very much longer than that. So, for example, compare it to the lifetime of a star. So the lifetime of the sun on the main sequence, where it's turning hydrogen into helium, is something like 10 billion years. So 10,000 million years. So if you compare 100,000 years to that, this light crossing time, that's only 1/100,000th of the lifetime of the star. So you wouldn't expect to see any appreciable difference in the properties of a star like the sun if you saw it, you know, if there was a star on the near side like the sun compared to a star on the far side of a galaxy like the sun. It would only be a very tiny fraction of its lifetime different. Even when you go to higher mass stars, let's say a 25 solar mass star, which burns its fuel faster and therefore has a shorter lifetime, its lifetime is still several million years. And even then, you're only talking about, you know, maybe 1 or 2% of the lifetime of the star. So it's getting a bit more significant, but still not huge. Now, returning to the particular point that Mark makes, which is the image of the galaxy distorted in some way? Because, of course, the galaxy's rotating. A galaxy like Andromeda, for example, is all the stars are moving on circular orbits around its centre. And therefore, if you're seeing the stars on the far side at a larger time into the past, looking farther back into the past than the stars on the near side, then maybe they're not actually in the same relative positions to each other. So there's some sort of shearing, some sort of twisting up of the galaxy as seen in the image that you see. The question is, how big an effect is that? Now, in fact, you know, my gut instinct was that it wasn't particularly a huge effect, just in the same way I've just discussed in terms of the fractional lifetime of the stars. But I thought I'd better check. And so I worked through a few numbers And worked it out for Andromeda, imagining, let's say, a star like the Sun at, you know, the same sort of distance that the Sun is from the centre of our Milky Way, which is about 8,000 parsecs, which is sort of 27,000 light years or so from the centre. Our Sun moves around the centre of our Milky Way at about 220 kilometres per second, something like that. So you can actually work out how far this star at the far side of the Andromeda galaxy would have moved relative to, say, a star at the near side. And it turns out that at the distance of Andromeda, it's actually offset by about 6 arc seconds. So an arc second's 1/3,600th of a degree. So it's a small angle on the sky, a very small change in the position of the star on the sky from where it would have been if they were all seen at the same time relative to the galaxy itself. But actually, interestingly enough, it's measurable because, you know, in an image that we take of, say, the Andromeda galaxy, then we might expect, say, an optical image of the galaxy seen with visible light. You might expect to be able to measure the positions of these stars accurate to a fraction of an arc second. Certainly, atmospheric seeing blurs the star positions to maybe about an arc second across, but you can measure the positions rather more accurately than that. So 6 arc seconds is measurable. Rather surprisingly, I guess. But of course, on the scale of Andromeda, Andromeda's several degrees across, and 1 arc second is, as I say, 1/3,600th of a degree. So it's a tiny distortion, although measurable. And of course, the real problem then is, what do you compare it to? How do you know what the galaxy structure would have been to compare these, you know, slightly changed positions with? There's nothing to compare it to. It's not like, you know, the galaxy's got some very nice straight lines drawn on it running out from the middle to the outside edge, and we can just see them start to curve a little bit as you see this distortion. So interestingly, it's a measurable effect for galaxies as close as Andromeda, but we wouldn't really, practically, it's hard to think of an example where it would matter, to be honest. So, interesting question from Mark. Next comment is from Miguel Werner, who wrote in from South America. And he was actually referring to these sorts of weird ideas that have been circulating about something strange going to happen in 2012. You know, of course, these sort of exaggerated conspiracy theories. But in fact, what he was commenting about was one of our news articles, which we released recently, which you might have seen on our website, which was about a mystery object in the Starburst Galaxy M82. And this was a story that a few of the astronomers here, Tom Muxlow in particular, have been monitoring M82, which is a galaxy with a lot of star formation going on in it. And therefore, because there's a lot of star formation, we call it a starburst. There's a lot of star death, the massive stars exploding as supernovae. And so they've been monitoring this galaxy for many years now, in particular looking at it with radio telescopes, which lets them see through the dust in the interstellar medium right into the heart of this galaxy, where you can see where most of these supernovae have been taking place. And back in just over a year ago, back in April 2009, just the beginning of May 2009, a new bright point of radio emission appeared near the core of M82. So the suspicion, of course, was that it was a new supernova that had exploded and was producing radio waves. But the problem was that, having monitored that object now, it doesn't really behave like any radio supernovae do that they've seen before. So it was very confusing as to what this was, and it's still quite unclear. And one of the interesting features of this was that they, with Merlin, using the array of radio telescopes here in the UK that's spread across about 200 kilometres, were able to measure positions very extremely accurately. And we were able to measure the position of this object, and it appeared that it was actually moving, and moving sideways at a speed which, given the distance to M82, put the speed at about 4 times the speed of light. And this was mentioned in the press release that we did, and in fact, you know, discussed and explained. Now, what Miguel was pointing out was that actually there had been some bizarre suggestions in some of the people worrying about what might happen in 2012, that maybe this object that had been discovered in M82 was actually going to crash into the Earth in 2012. Now, there's a few points about that, of course. One is that that even if something were coming all the way towards us from M82, it's actually about 13 million light years away. So we certainly wouldn't, even travelling at the speed of light, we certainly wouldn't have to worry about it arriving for some time yet. But also this sort of confusion, I guess, about things moving at an apparent speed faster than that of light. Because, of course, what we're not saying is that there's actually motion that's actually faster than the speed of light. It's just apparently faster than the speed of light. This so-called superluminal motion. And just to clarify what that is, if you imagine an object, let's say in this case, it might be that this one theory for what this mystery object might be is that it could be something like a microquasar, which is a stellar system with a black hole in it, companion star, materials falling in towards the black hole. And occasionally these systems eject material. They have outbursts in which material is ejected at very high speeds. Not faster than the speed of light, but appreciable fractions of the speed of light, depending on the object, maybe 0.7, 0.8, 0.9, even, you know, very close to the speed of light. And now if you imagine one of the sort of blob of material being shot out from the region around near this black hole, and if you imagine that blob sort of coming not quite directly towards us, but sort of at an angle to the line of sight, towards us, and then we sort of take two pictures and we measure it as we did with this particular object. We take a picture on one day, take a picture a few days later or a few weeks later. So when we come to calculate the apparent speed of this blob as it's moving, then what we're going to do is divide the sort of distance by time. But during the time we're between the two images, it turns out the blob's actually got closer to us. And so the time taken for the light to get to us from the second position is actually less because of the fact that the blob is closer to us. And when you allow for that, when you divide that distance by time, because that time is shortened because the blob's actually got closer to you, the speed that you get is artificially boosted, because you're dividing distance by time, you're dividing by a shorter time, so you get a larger speed. And you can actually just work that out and work out by what factor the apparent speed compares to the speed of light. And it turns out, for, you know, plausible values of the actual speed of the blob as some sort of fraction like 0.8, 80% of the speed of light or something, you can actually get particular ranges of angles at which it's coming towards you for which the speed you would apparently measure from the two images is some factor greater than the speed of light. So anyway, just to clarify, we haven't detected anything that's actually moving faster than the speed of light intrinsically. It just appears to be. And also there's certainly no way in which that thing is coming towards us that it's going to actually crash into us and cause some hideous problem in 2012. Okay, the next question we've got is from Martin, who hails from Dublin in Ireland. And he says, do you think my newborn child will see an unmanned interstellar probe being launched during his lifetime? How far away are we from launching such a mission? What are the main hurdles? I guess the propulsion is important, but what are any other hurdles? And when do you guesstimate an interstellar mission will be launched, if at all? Okay, I guess the first thing to point out about interstellar probes is that, in a sense, we've launched one, because of course, several, in fact, the Voyager spacecraft are heading out of left the solar system now, heading out into interstellar space. Not actually, of course, designed to be interstellar probes, but certainly going that way now. And if we'd sent something like Voyager towards the nearest star, something like moving at about 20 kilometers a second, it would still take Voyager to travel to about 80,000 years to get to the nearest star. So I guess that's the first major problem with thinking about interstellar missions, is that the sorts of speeds we've built spacecraft to travel at so far, it's, you know, ridiculously long amounts of time. Now, it doesn't mean to say you can't send them out there, and indeed they are going out there now. But I suppose the big question would be why? You know, what would be your motivation for doing this? Normally, I guess most of us are motivated by things that occur on our human timescales, in other words, within our lifetime. So we certainly don't often get PhD students who want to start doing PhD projects from which they won't see the result for 80,000 years. So, you know, I think that would be one big motivator. Why would we bother to send out an unmanned interstellar probe for which the results would not be returned for many, many thousands of years? Now, one issue that's obviously often discussed is that if one tries to do things faster, travel faster, so travel at speeds approaching that of light, then we get this effect called time dilation, which is a consequence of Einstein's special theory of relativity, which means it's commonly known as moving clocks run slow. So from the point of view of an occupant of a spacecraft which travels at a very high fraction of the speed of light, it actually, for them, it takes less time for them to travel these distances. So, for example, if you were to imagine a spacecraft travelling at 0.995 the speed of light, and they were travelling, say, 10 light years, from a point of view of someone on the Earth, that would take them about 10.05 years, so just over 10 years because they're travelling a little less than the speed of light. But from the point of view of any occupant of the spacecraft, they'd actually only age just over a year, 1.004 years during the trip. Now, obviously, that helps if you've got a spacecraft with humans on board, because the travel time is much reduced for them. But it doesn't really help from the point of an Earthbound observer. Still takes the same amount of time. And indeed, you know, if you had an unmanned spacecraft, as we're referring to here, it doesn't really make any odds. But one thing it does mean is that if we were, as a practical effect for an unmanned probe, is that when we accelerate this spacecraft that, you know, normal speeds would take many thousands of years to reach, say, even the nearest star, if we try accelerating that to close to the speed of light, the trouble is the amount of energy required, what special relativity tells us is the amount of energy required is huge. So so I think the problem with fast interstellar travel is the energy requirements really are pretty unreasonable. So you've got to rely on slow interstellar travel. If you're talking about unmanned probes, you've got to ask, why would you bother? What would be the purpose, given it's so slow you don't get any results back from that survey for many, many years? I guess if you think about colonisation, one interesting thing is that even travelling at rather low speeds, you know, maybe 1% the speed of light or something, where you might plausibly be able to work out an energy budget that would be affordable, it turns out that, you know, you could perhaps travel to the nearby stars in 1,000 years or so, and maybe you'd be prepared to have generations of colonists on board the spacecraft live and die. If those colonists sort of got to the nearest star in 1,000 years, I guess, and then perhaps moved on, they know how to build these spacecraft, so they think, okay, we're a bit bored with this new planet, we'll move on to another one, hang around for a few hundred years and then move on, you can work out how long it would take a sort of wave of colonization to spread across the galaxy, and estimates would, you know, you could put that at maybe only a few tens of millions of years. Sounds like a long time to cross the whole galaxy, a few tens of millions of years, but of course, you know, on the lifetime of the galaxy, our sun's been around for 5 billion years, 5,000 million years. So a few tens of millions of years is only a small fraction. So it seems that, you know, if any civilization ever got to that point where they decided that interstellar colonization was an interesting thing to do, it seems like they might actually be able to do it relatively quickly. And therefore, you know, that leads to this famous paradox known as the Fermi or Hart paradox. Is if aliens exist, extraterrestrials exist, why aren't they here already? Because, you know, if they thought of colonizing space, they would have colonized space, they would have been able to spread across the galaxy. So, of course, there are a number of answers to that question, and it's not really the place here to discuss those. Perhaps another time. Now, the final question for this month is also from Martin. He sneaked in a couple of questions. He says, do we know more about our closest stars than those further away? Does it matter if a star is 4 light years away or 1,000 light years away when it comes to the information we get when we point a telescope at it? Obviously, you'd imagine that if something was closer to you, you'd be able to find out more about it. Now, that's true for stars in certain circumstances. There's certain properties that we're able to measure more easily. One example is sort of measuring the position of a star and indeed its distance. So you may have heard of parallax, which is in effect, you know, you stretch out your arm, raise one finger, close one eye and look at the position of your finger relative to the background, and then change eyes. You'll see your finger moves against the background. That same effect you get when you take pictures of nearby stars. With the Earth at one position in its orbit, say, and with it on the other extreme of its orbit 6 months later. And that parallax gives us probably, you know, the most accurate distances to stars. Now, that's easier to do the closer a star is to us. You might be able to measure the movement of a star in a binary system just by measuring its position, for example, if it's close enough to us to resolve, to see that movement. Similarly, the closer stars, closer and larger stars, you might actually be able to use high-resolution imaging to resolve the disk of the star. But actually, in general, what matters most about the information we can find out about stars is their brightness. And it's true to say that if I take a particular star, bring it closer to us, it will, of course, appear brighter, and that will be helpful to us. But often stars spread across a very large range of brightness. Typically, stars are rather fainter than the Sun. The star is actually not that average. It's actually brighter than the average. And in the region of the solar neighbourhood, in the region of space around the Sun, most stars are actually much less massive than the Sun. They're so-called M-type dwarfs. They're sort of cool red dwarfs, less massive than the Sun, and therefore rather fainter than the Sun. So you imagine looking around in space, you might think, oh, well, we know about all the stars that are close to us and we know a huge amount of information about them. Well, that's not actually true. Because these stars are relatively faint, they're not that obvious. And then we have to determine that they're close to us. We need to somehow be able to work out their distance. And that's not too easy a thing to do. So just for example, there's a project, a collaboration called RECONS, which stands for Research Consortium on Nearby Stars. And they've been trying to tie down really what the properties of the stellar populations are within, the closest stars to the Sun, within 10 parsecs or within 25 parsecs or so of the Sun. So that's sort of 30 light years or so away. Now, interestingly, they report that in the year 2000, there were 215 stellar systems known within 10 parsecs of the Sun, within about 30 light years of the Sun. Whereas in 2009, there were 249, so it had gone up from 215 to 249, an extra 34 stellar systems just in the last decade discovered very close to the Sun. Now, in fact, the majority of these stars are these M-type dwarfs, 72% of them. So, in fact, the numbers of M dwarfs have gone up from 199 to 239, whereas other types of star, like G-type stars, like the Sun, there's 21 of those within 10 parsecs of the Sun, and that was the case in the year 2000. It's still the case in 2009. Similarly, white dwarf stars, the remnants of stars like the Sun when they've evolved through the red giant phase, those white dwarfs, there's about 18 known in 2000, and similarly 18 known in 2009. So I would say that whether the distance to a star matters about what you can find out about it, well, it does for certain specific things, but in general, the most important thing is the brightness. And that will be, the apparent brightness of the star will depend on both its distance and its intrinsic brightness. And when you've got a bright star, you can, for example, split that light into a spectrum. You've got a large number of photons, let's say, and that gives you very high signal-to-noise measurements, which lets you determine very particular properties of that star, like its composition and its size, effective gravity, and so on and so forth. So brightness is what matters mostly. That's it for this month's Ask an Astronomer. If you've got any questions you'd like answered, then send them in by the usual routes. And I'll speak to you again next month.